KPCW News Time now, 8:06. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. We've got 61 degrees here in Old Town Park City, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Yeah, another day of upper 80s for those daytime highs. We will see partly cloudy skies for a good portion of the day, mixed in with a little bit of haze as well, especially this afternoon. But the mid to upper 80s continue here, both today, tomorrow, and into Saturday. Now, tomorrow will be a little bit more interesting. We do have red flag warnings that expire later this evening at 10 for the Wasatch Back, related to gusty winds up to 30 miles per hour from the west. And that, of course, could lead to new fire starts. However, with that being said, tomorrow we are looking at an elevated fire threat for the fact that we have the possibility of some dry thunderstorms that could develop here in the afternoon and evening hours related to the heating of the day, but this high that's causing all this record heat, pulling in some moisture and allowing for those dry thunderstorms to develop. If they do, the biggest problem is that they're going to be dry lightning, and that dry lightning could lead to new fire starts, and then around any type of dry thunderstorm, you have the gusty outflow wind. So it's something that we need to keep in mind and stay vigilant about, especially if we're going to be out and about for any of these that might pop. And this will also be the case here into the Saturday time frame. Not a whole lot of wetting storms, unfortunately, just the dry. We'll get into the low 80s here for Sunday and Monday for your Father's Day, but they look super sunny both those days, Sunday and Monday. The winds will slightly increase as well during this time frame before we kind of more or less start heading towards the mid-80s yet again next week as triple-digit heat returns for the Wasatch Front. The latest drought monitor came out today. We were last week at 64% of the state under exceptional. There was no change in that, so that's at least a little bit of good news, but also no decrease in any of our drought either. So we continue on with no rain.
Okay, boy, sure could use some. Hey, thanks.
Absolutely. You bet.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Fire Chief Ernie Giles with an update on fire restrictions and fireworks there in Wasatch County. The CEO of Ski Utah, Nathan Rafferty, will be in with news on the end of the ski season numbers. And finally, Park City Film Director Katie Wang and Mateo Ochoa, Senior Manager of Community Programs with Sundance Institute, will have a preview of the films that are part of the Latino Arts Festival. Stay tuned.
It's tough staying on top of today's headlines. So much is happening, and it's hard to tell what's fact and what's not. KPCW is dedicated to presenting the most thorough, accurate information possible. We bring you Morning Edition every day of the week, along with NPR headlines at the top of every hour and BBC News overnight. Plus, our news team is constantly on watch to report the stories you need to know in your own backyard. KPCW, where news matters.
And stay tuned, coming up right after the local news hour for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include astrobiologist Caleb Scharf. He argues that all of the data that we create with all of our emails, tweets, selfies, and text amount to an aggregate life form, a life form that has goals and needs. Then Dr. Albert Chun discusses peripheral artery disease known as PAD. He talks about how healthcare technology is creating solutions for patients with this disease, including stents coated with medications, as well as other exciting innovations. Again, all of that coming up on today's edition of Cool Science Radio. You can hear that at 9:06. Well, the more than $150 million in school facility expansions are moving ahead in the Park City School District. Park City Board of Education received an update at their meeting Tuesday and gave School District Business Administrator Todd Halbert the authorization to proceed. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has this update.
The Park City School District Master Plan entails renovating and expanding six of the seven schools in the district. The changes would accommodate grade realignments and new programming. The total price tag is $153 million to move ninth grade into the high school, move eighth grade into Ecker Hill Middle School, and expand all four elementary schools to offer universal pre-K and wraparound after and before school services. The administration will identify a selection committee that will consider cost proposals.
So the timeline is the responders have until July 2nd to put their qualification packets together. The selection committee will then start its work and put its recommendation together for board review. The simultaneous with that will be the request for proposals. So we'll qualify up to three firms, and then we'll talk to those three firms and say, here's the very specifics of the project. We know you can do it. Now this is what we want you to do.
The selection committee will make a recommendation to the board during the August 17th meeting. Hauber said they were happy with the responses from the architecture, design, and engineering firms interested in bidding. As a result, work could begin as soon as this fall. The board hasn't decided how they will finance the school district building projects.
So at this point, we don't have anything locked in. The opportunity that's before the board is to talk about a general obligation bond, and they can do that through a resolution. And that August 17th meeting would be the last opportunity they have to adopt a resolution for this election cycle. So we'll probably get very serious at that August 17th meeting about what exactly we will do to finance.
If the board determines a general obligation bond is the way to go, they'll look at all six school facilities projects.
So we want to look holistically at all of the capital projects and put a bond proposition together, should that be the decision, that encompasses the whole gamut of what we're looking at. The high school project obviously is one of those elements that would be in that proposition.
If a school bond doesn't pass, Hauber said the needs of the district don't change. Instead, they'll look at other financing options.
The underlying need of the district hasn't changed, regardless of the financing option. We have that need to bring the ninth graders into the high school. We have the need to bring the eighth graders over to Ecker Hill, and the opportunities for preschool. Those exist. So we would have to find a financing option that then helps support those goals. And whether it's a lease revenue, it may be that it happens in pieces over time so that it fits more the conventional size of a lease revenue bond. But in the end, the need is still there, and so we'd find a way to fill that need.
Hauber said they want to move quickly and get students into the new buildings as soon as possible.
So in a GO bond, you're seeking authorization for whatever the level is, call it the $153 million right now. And you have 10 years in which to exercise that authority. We've pushed much of the scheduling very early in that 10-year time frame. And so within the first 3 years is when we would like to have everything all done and taken care of.
Financial advisors have provided scenarios outlining the cost to taxpayers for the two different options, the lease revenue bonds and the general obligation bond. If growth trends stay the same on assessed valuations, it will reduce the burden on individual taxpayers.
So what we're looking at is something that's probably in the $5 to $6 million range for principal and interest on an annual basis. The principal and interest payment will still be the same, so that responsibility doesn't change. But how much an individual might pay towards that will.
School board will have to decide on a GO bond financing option during the August 17th meeting to meet state requirements for a bond initiative to be put on November's ballot. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
News time now, 8:14. Well, yesterday, Wasatch County implemented new fire and fireworks restrictions. In the studio with details, I have Wasatch County Fire Chief Ernie Giles. Good morning, Ernie.
Good morning.
So the, let's see here. I'm going to need you to actually use that other microphone there, if you would. Yeah, one of the others. That one didn't get hooked up for some reason. Thanks. So the statewide restrictions for unincorporated lands announced last week, more restrictions went into effect yesterday. So these were just for counties and municipalities then?
That's correct. Municipalities have to pass an ordinance to actually be able to cite the folks that break the law. So they're in the process. I know Heber's holding an emergency meeting today to do that, and we're working with the other cities and townships to get that done.
Okay. So they're just similar restrictions, though? No open fires, no fireworks?
Correct, yep. No open flame other than a propane, no briquettes, any wood, anything like that. The Forest Service has also went into stage two, which is no campfires other than in camp areas that similar to Strawberry and those type camping spots out in the woods. There's no fires allowed.
Yeah. So in terms of the fire season that you're seeing this year so far, I mean, you've already had the first one there at the Wasatch Mountain State Park?
Yes. Yeah. We've had several over there. control burner got out of control in Big Pole a couple of weeks ago, and then this fire was unattended by a camper, and wind came up, and we were very fortunate to get it out as early as we did.
Yeah, it required evacuation of the entire campground?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, appreciation to the state parks for helping with that. The sheriff's office, Heber City PD was there. Lots of folks to... It's a tight little campground, and to evacuate trailers and people's personal belongings takes a minute, so...
Well, that's what I was wondering. It wasn't just people left. They were able to pack up their stuff, take it with?
Some, mainly their truck and campers or trailers to get them out. I know some left boats, bikes, and that type of thing, but we were, like I say, very fortunate to get that west flank cut off.
Yeah. You know. Now, are the campers then fined for leaving that unattended campfire, or the restrictions weren't in effect at that point, so there is no
Yeah,
basis?
They wasn't in effect, but they could have been cited for leaving an unattended fire. So anytime, even without the restrictions, if you leave a fire unattended, you're responsible for it.
Yeah, so what, did they just go off to play golf or for a bike ride or something?
I think they left.
Oh.
From my understanding, their time was up at the camp spot, and I think they had pulled out, thinking the fire was safe in that ring. But no fire, the way the season is, you know, they need to be dead out.
And that requires, what, just a lot of water on it?
Water, stirring, you know, stirring the coals and the ashes. It may not be smoking, but the heat down inside those coals, wind come up and can carry a spark, and as dry as the grass is, it seems like you could start it with your breath, it seems like, out there.
Yeah, it's like a blow dryer out there anyway. So are you staffed up, though, to handle what could be a long fire season?
We've got most all our equipment pretty well in tip-top shape, and have been doing lots of training lately and trying to be proactive. We've got some signs that's going to be placed throughout the county today, 3x5 signs that says fire restrictions, that also has WasatchCountyFire.com on it that can pull up and you can read what the restrictions are, but they'll be placed in areas where high traffic and campers may be going.
Yeah. You've got, I believe, 5 fire stations, but only staff 2 of them full-time?
That's correct. Yes. Yep.
And is that done just because you don't have the funds to staff all of them all the time? Or just not needed?
No, it's probably everywhere. We're busy. We're actually in the process of an RFP to build a new station out on 12th South, and about, I think it's about 190 East. And hopefully within the next couple of years, we'll have that station built and it will be occupied. The other stations that we don't occupy doesn't have living quarters, so they're mainly garages to store equipment.
Ah, okay. So it's the Jordan L. Fire station, the Midway, and then this Heber City one would all be fully staffed?
That'd be correct, yes.
Okay. And are there plans then to add on to the others so that you could have?
Yeah, the Heber station is on First West and First South, and it's mainly a garage. There's not enough room there to do it. And currently it's owned by the county. The district doesn't own that one, but the district purchased just a short under 5 acres out on 12th where this new station will be. And it, like I say, it'll probably be a couple of years before we get it built and occupied.
So you do have some fully paid staff and then the rest are volunteer?
Yes, we actually, currently right now, there's 36 full-time employees with the office folks, the marshal, training officers and such. So we're actually in a process currently right now of advertising and gonna hire 4 additional firefighters.
Oh, for this year then?
Yeah, and that'll make a total of 40. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then you're also gonna hire a new captain?
New captain, yes. Wait, the policy and procedures asks or requires that we go in-house first for qualified apps, and if not, we reach out. And also a battalion chief is actually being advertised, or not a battalion chief, a deputy chief is being sought after currently right now. That position will more than likely move into chief position when I leave.
Okay, when's that?
Good question. You know, just with the fires, you know, the dry conditions and how busy the building is, you know, I'm just not sure. Hopefully within the next 2 to 3 years, get him in, get his feet wet, working with these developers and people and getting familiarized with the county, and then I can hopefully step back and let him take the reins.
All right, so a new station, four new firefighters. What other equipment? It looked like you were out to buy a new ambulance as well.
Yeah, we're actually currently have a Pierce pumper that's actually being built right now. Currently, it's supposed to be delivered in January, and we've had a couple of remounts on our ambulances. They're basically, they take the back of the ambulance off and put it on a new chassis, which saves the taxpayers roughly between $80,000 and $100,000. So it's been great. It's worked out good. I'm gonna fly down to Vegas and pick another one up that's being remounted on the 29th of this month.
All right. You've also expressed concern that you don't think you have the equipment to put out a jet fuel fire. Something happened at the airport. Is that going to be remedied?
Yeah, that's a great question. A fellow by the name of Merle Rollins works for the state, and he was able to get us an ARF truck, which is an aircraft-equipped pumper, and we sent it down to Henderson, Nevada, to have it looked into, rebuilt, and refurbished. It actually came back to town last Saturday, so we're going to train up on it in the next 2-3 weeks and have it available if there's lots of planes taking off and landing in that airport. It's like everywhere busy.
Yeah. So what's different about putting out a jet fuel fire as opposed to, you know, a structure fire?
Yeah, generally on a structure fire, we're dealing with wood, plastics. Water generally does a great job with that. Jet fuel, water does suppress the frame somewhat, but there's a powder and a foam system that we can actually, this truck will actually produce lots of foam and lots of chemical to actually put these jet fuel fires out.
Okay. So you should have that shortly? It's just a matter of training with it?
Yeah, just a matter of getting some training done in the next 2 to 3 weeks, and that'll be available to actually, I hope we never have to use it.
And I just noticed this morning that you're selling off some of your surplus vehicles to the public?
Yes, that's correct. They can view those at First West and First South in Heber. There's a couple of full ambulances. They have heat and AC in the back. I mean, for a construction or a camping person may be interested in them. There's a couple of these chassis that I was talking about earlier that actually doesn't have a bed on the back. And then a pickup that was used for, well, back in the day it was my truck, and you know, it's handed down, and now it's time to get rid of it.
Yeah. Are you going to need to raise taxes this year in order to do all of this?
Great question. I've actually been working with the tax people and the tax coalition of Heber. If we don't hold our mill levy where it is, if most people understand what that does, it drives the mill levy down. You can only collect so much money other than new growth. I just visited with them yesterday. I think I'm going to hold our mill levy steady, which is roughly about $200,000 according to the state tax commission. So that's kind of my thoughts right now, to try to keep up with just inflation is basically what holding this mill levy does.
In terms of paying for our new fire station, though, that's not cheap. Where does the money come to do that?
Uh, currently right now, we implemented an impact fee a year ago in January, and we've used those funds to purchase the property. They can only be used for certain things, capital improvements, building a new station, or buying property, or buying equipment over $500,000. So that's the hopefully going to be our revenue source to actually fund this station and not have to go out after taxpayer money to do that.
Okay. I'm going to get back to that impact fee. Just want to report we've had word of an accident on inbound 248 there at the Narrows. Apparently a car and a deer involved. All traffic was being held by the fire department, but it looks like traffic is slowly moving now again. So for those of you headed into Park City on 248 there, traffic is slowing down, but it sounds like they're going to be able to move it shortly. So the impact fees, you didn't have any impact fees before last January, huh? January 2020?
That's correct. It was actually, we had a study done, and it the fee was fairly new to the district at that point in time. I'm talking 10 years ago. And so it was created as an emergency services fee. And the fire district had, halfway through it, had went out and done their own, but it never got codified after it got approved. And so we always thought it was part of it until we'd done this second study a couple of years ago and found out that that wasn't the case.
Yikes. So went for several years and without collecting, huh?
Yes. The emergency fee was, but it wasn't pertaining to the fire district.
All right. Well, it sounds like now we've got some disagreement with the Mayflower Mountain Resort beginning its vertical construction, the developer there, Extel, not wanting to pay the new fees as implemented. So tell me what's happening there.
They have paid the fee. They have paid it under protest, and they have, you know, brought up some good points. The misconfusion or what the protest was filed under is they have some 400 square foot studios in these apartment complexes, and they don't feel like that they ought to be charged a residential fee for the 400 square foot versus, they use the analogy of a 4,000 square foot home. But if this 400 square foot studio was standing alone by itself, I think I would understand their argument. But as it is, it's in a building that we got to evacuate roughly from 1,000 to 2,500 people. If there's something going on there, a fire, emergency, it's, these apartment complexes just take more personnel. I mean, the law enforcement, they're upstairs generally. I mean, you have to get them in the elevator, and it just takes a lot more time to do that. And I think through the discussion, I hope the district and Extel can come together without having to go to legal or the court systems. I think we're going to be able to work it out.
Is that... because I noticed that you did go into closed session to discuss litigation. Is that something that's being considered, getting sued over the impact fees?
Any time somebody files under protest, it, you know, actually raises a flag of, you know, litigation. And so we want to be cautious. We want to be, you know, good neighbors with them and, you know, try to work with them the best we can without having to spend money going through a court system to do that. And I believe we're going to be able to. It's they have a argument on their side and we do on ours. And it's like I say, these big buildings take a lot more personnel, and especially on an evacuation. You just think, you know, right now the heat's a factor, but when it's 30 below outside, it's a whole different ball game to house these people and keep them safe when you have them evacuated. And so, you know, on the fee, I look at it, it's a one in a lifetime fee of the building. I mean, you spread this out over 100 years, the fee really isn't that great. But the ordinance does give them an opportunity to actually question it, and so that's kind of where we're at right now.
So ultimately, whose decision is it? Is it the board for the fire board, or is it the Wasatch County Council's?
They're the same folks. Yeah, the same people do that, and it'll be a decision them and how they feel like, and the negotiations of, you know, hopefully we can meet in the middle and make this thing work for both sides.
Yeah, there was some talk I had heard that Extel just offered to buy you a fire engine. You'd probably rather have the money, though, huh?
Yeah. Originally, you know, we had talked about an aerial device platform with them early on and front-loading the help, the station, because if you've been by there, it's a big project. But they're not the only ones there. I mean, there's plenty of subdivisions going on the east side, the highway too, that needs to be part of it. And I just felt like this impact fee was more of a fair and equitable way to spread that out amongst everybody.
Okay, so will all of the new buildings in Wasatch County, are they required to have fire suppression built in?
Not currently right now under the state code. The legislature changed that about 2 years ago. We had required anything in the urban interface areas to actually have fire suppression inside the homes. And since then, the legislature has deemed only like 5 trigger points that actually can require fire sprinklers.
So I'm just wondering if that's something that might be reconsidered given what we know today.
I would hope a tool that works over 97% of the time, it's, you know, disheartening not to use that, and it's, the cost is not that great, and especially for a residential home.
Yeah. All right, Ernie, anything else you want to mention?
No, I just appreciate the time, and I just would caution all the citizens to be very safe and watchful. A fire can, even a chain can spark a fire, parking your car on grass. So just be safe and keep your eye out.
Okay. Ernie, thanks for coming in.
You bet. Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Fire Chief Ernie Giles again. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. News time now, 8:34. 8:34 now. Good morning. Well, Ski Utah reporting its highest skier day visitation year ever, and that in the face of a pandemic. In the studio to explain how that could happen when numbers were limited is the CEO of Ski Utah, Nathan Rafferty. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie.
So I think we're all scratching our heads a bit, wondering how we can smash a skier day record when Utah reservations were required. We had the number of people on a chairlift limited. And really, I mean, not a great snowpack on the books.
You know, I was scratching my head a little bit myself, quite honestly. Numbers were rolling in at the end of the year, and I thought, oh my gosh, really? Are we doing this? And sure enough, and yeah, we saw records fall across the state. You know, and I think it comes down to, well, you know, this season was an anomaly like no other. And really what happened was exactly what the resorts had planned and hoped for, which was lopping off the kind of peaks of these weekends, Saturdays, holidays, and shifting all the skiing to weekdays and downtimes and afternoons. You know, I went out and skied at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, parked on the front row, and you know, we just kind of got out of our normal routine of skiing, and it paid off in a big way for our industry, you know, clocking that 5.3 million skier days.
Yeah. So yeah, you reported that resorts in total set the record, but did so without breaking any single day record. How far off were we from that?
I don't know. We don't dive that deep into the info from the resorts, but that was those were just some of the comments we got from some of the resort GMs that said, yeah, we had a record year and we'd never set a record single day record, which is exactly what they were hoping for and planned for.
Yeah, so just busy every day. Like I said, I mean, at the beginning of the season, I said every day is going to be Saturday.
Yeah, and you know, talking to a friend in the golf industry, you know, the menu of things to do during COVID was so much shorter than what we're used to, and you know, people spent a lot of time skiing and outdoors, and we were really grateful as an industry to be able to offer that for people, something to do in January and in Utah, and people took advantage, so we were thrilled.
Yeah, and how much do you think it impacted us? us, given that I think like maybe Vermont, I mean, I don't even know that they opened to out-of-state residents. California, I think they also had a lot of closures.
Yeah, you know, it was a huge help. So the state of Utah was, I'd say, more open than some of our competitive states. And our competitive states are, well, certainly Canada. You can't go to Whistler. And we were probably more open than Colorado, certainly more open than California, and absolutely more open than Vermont. Those are kind of the top three or four big ski regions. And, I also have to thank the Utah Office of Tourism that I met weekly with them. I'm on their marketing committee and on their board of directors, and the messaging that they kept going throughout the pandemic saying, hey, when you're ready to ski, when you're ready to visit us, we're here and we're open. And a lot of our competitive the other states that we compete against, turned off their advertising altogether. So, a lot of different factors benefiting our skier day record.
Yeah, and then certainly we added another resort, Woodward, right? I mean, did that make a difference?
Absolutely. And every day I came home from work, the parking lot was packed, and I saw a ton of people on the chairlift, and they skied late and often, and they've been cranking, and what an awesome addition to our community Woodward has been.
Yeah, and we're also seeing, Deer Valley being one of those adding the RFID system, that radio frequency, in terms of the ski passes. It may just be we have a better count than we ever had before.
Yeah, but they did that last year, right? So we do, and we've seen that for every resort that comes. It used to be, if you bought a season pass, they would just take that number of season passes and multiply it towards a number that they thought was the average, and it was fairly accurate, but certainly not as accurate as are these RFID, and where we know, to the number, how many people are skiing or riding day, night, afternoon, whenever.
So any other states that you've heard of that have broken skier day, like Colorado maybe?
Or? I haven't heard any state numbers yet. I would suspect Colorado did really well. I would think that Montana and Wyoming did well. They were also open. One really outlier for us was the fact that we had such, really average snowfall, below average, in fact. And I've never seen a skier day record fall without having exceptional snow. And we were, 70, 75% of average? That's still 400 and something inches over at Alta, but not what we're used to.
So as things are opening back up, does this all come crashing to a halt next season then? Or
I don't think so. I think a lot of people got off the couch and rediscovered skiing as a sport, and people bought season passes that maybe had never had one or hadn't had one in a long time. We hope they invested in equipment and those shiny new skis or snowboard is going to be staring them in the face next fall, and they're going to remember how much fun they had. So we hope that we can hang on to some of these lapsed skiers and riders, as we call them, for at least a couple years, if not forever.
Yeah. Well, and that's what you've always kind of hoped for, was to see some of that spread out during the week.
Yeah,
I don't know if we've got that opportunity, though, in the future.
It just took a global pandemic for us to be able to see that spread out like that.
What does this mean then for you in terms of marketing dollars at next year's legislative session? Because it's that money is based on skier days, right?
Not necessarily based on skier days, but it's a good story for us to tell. And this is, almost a $2 billion industry in our state, and the legislative leaders understand that. They know that tourism is a huge chunk of Utah's economy and brings a ton of local and state tax dollars. So I suspect that they are going to be happy and hopefully continue those tourism promotional dollars.
Yeah, and I haven't heard the results from Vail Resorts in terms of their earnings yet, but I'm just wondering again, because the restaurants being shut down, limited lessons, things like that, so we may not see such a great profit year.
Sure, and we don't see that data. Oftentimes we do research every year. We didn't do it this year because it involves us sitting on a chairlift with a stranger and talking to him and asking him questions. So we won't have as clear a picture on that, but there's certainly, I think, revenue in some cases is down with the limited capacity at the restaurants. Some of the resorts that have hotels like Snowbird really suffered from a lack of convention business, which is cranking back now, by the way. But yeah, that was a rough go in some of those different revenue streams.
Yeah, and of course, resorts were hit with the fact that they couldn't have their J-1, H-2P visa employees, and with resorts struggling to find workers. I think it was the National Skiers Association reporting that the average ski area was short 55 employees this year. Given that we didn't have that workforce, it probably could have been an even better year, I guess, huh?
Yeah, and that, you know, I think 15 of our 15 resorts would tell you that labor is their number one problem right now. All of them that are getting ready for summer operations are really scrambling to find employees, and I'm sure that'll continue into the fall, but we're working hard as an industry to work with our legislative leaders back in Congress to help with the J-1 issue and just continue to refine that. So I think we'll be in good shape come ski season, but it's not without a little bit of a struggle for sure.
Okay, and I'm guessing you're already working on it, though. What's next winter's marketing message going to be?
Come ski in Utah. You know, we had a great year last year, and we're going to continue to have great years. And there's a lot of exciting stuff going on in the state. I was just down at Sundance last night, and they've got brand new lift going on, and you know, a lot of stuff happening here in Park City with the redevelopment of some of the base areas, and I think we're going to see a lot of good stuff in Utah for years to come. Very bright future in terms of skiing.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
No, I'm just happy to talk about skiing during these dog days of summer. So hot out there.
Okay. Hey, Nathan, thanks.
Thank you.
Nathan Rafferty is the CEO of Ski Utah. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, getting around Old Town just got a little bit easier. The Main Street trolley service is back for the summer. It was cut last winter and wasn't budgeted for this summer, but the City Council decided to bring it back for limited hours starting July 1st. Park City Transit is funded through sales tax. City Manager Matt Dias told KPCW last November that the service was cut because the city was expecting significant shortfalls from sales tax revenue last winter. However, the city announced at Tuesday's historic Park City Alliance meeting that they will resume service. Alliance Executive Director Allison Kulo says the community is excited to welcome back the popular and much-used transportation method.
Having this trolley on Main Street is such a huge benefit, especially when a lot of the people visiting town aren't used to the elevation and because of the street steepness of the grade.
The trolley will run 10 hours a day, 4 days a week, Wednesday through Saturday, with Main Street closed for car-free Sundays and the Silly Market. A shuttle will be making trips up and down Sweet Alley. And throughout the state, municipalities are enacting water conservation efforts to mitigate effects of the drought. We'll have that story in just a minute. It's hot, but perfect weather for the drive-in. And on the phone with me, I've got Katie Wang, Executive Director of Park City Film. She's joined by Mateo Ochoa, Senior Manager of Community Programs for the Sundance Institute. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Katie, let's just start with you. Maybe give us the rundown of films outside at the UOP.
Yeah, so we've had a great success, and we're happy to see families and independent film lovers back at the Utah Olympic Park enjoying films under the stars. We're programmed out through the rest of June with films to be announced for July, August, and September. But this week, we're partnering with Summit County Behavioral Health for two free film screenings tonight, which also includes a meal for families with registration. The first film is at 7 o'clock, and it's Spy Kids, which is a tale of adventure by director Robert Rodriguez. This will be in English. It stars Antonio Banderas. It's a story about two ex-spies who are captured by an evil genius and have to be rescued by their spy-in-training kids. And then at 9 p.m., we're showing Capture the Flag in Spanish with English subtitles. And this is kind of a fun celebration of the anniversary of the first man landing on the moon, so a race to the moon to capture that flag. Admission is free for both films, but advanced registration is required. Currently, we have a wait list for Spy Kids, so if you want to see that film, just come on up a little early, and we'll try to get you in if people don't show up. And then Saturday night, we have two films that speak to the spirit of adventure and love of the environment in Park City. 8 o'clock is the new film, Forever Is Now, by Sean Slobodan. And it's a film about Zion National Park. And we'll also have a selection of his short films that celebrate the arts and culture in Salt Lake City. And a portion of ticket sales will be donated to benefit Zion National Park. And then at 9:30, we have A Biker's Ballad, which is Matchsticks Productions' inaugural bike film, bringing the Stoke to the dirt trails and celebrating the sport as only they know how. And then next week, and this is why Mateo is here with us this morning, we're excited to be part of Latino Arts Fest. We're partnering with the Christian Center and Sundance Institute to present two free films on Thursday, June 24th, up at the Utah Olympic Park. And 7 o'clock, Park City Film has curated La Bamba, the classic film about the groundbreaking career of musician Richie Valens, a young Mexican-American boy who rose from the fields of California to the top of the music charts and has some great toe-tapping selections if you're familiar with the film. And then I'll let Mateo talk about our film at 9:30.
Yes, of course. Thanks for having me. So we are actually screening Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go For It. So for those of you who don't know, that film premiered at the 2021 Sundance Film Festival this last year. And it's a documentary film about the legend herself, the Puerto Rican actress Rita Moreno. And it tells the story of just her groundbreaking success as an actress and as a star. And we get a chance to hear from her friends and co-stars like Lin-Manuel Miranda, Gloria Estefan, Hector Alonso, Eva Longoria, and then, of course, her recent co-star from One Day at a Time, Justina Machado, and many more. And so I think it's going to be a really great night to just go outside and watch some films, especially as it relates to Latinx experiences and stories across the diaspora.
Yeah. So this actually premiered at this year's film festival, yeah?
It did.
Yeah. What can you tell us a little bit about Rita Moreno?
Yeah, so Rita Moreno is an actress from Puerto Rico, and, you know, she came from a humble upbringing and essentially dealing with relentless racism as she navigated, you know, the media, right, especially as an actress. But she's one of the few Latinx people who won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony over her 70-year career, which is massively impressive. And, you know, I think it's just really wonderful for us to kind of put her at the center, especially during the Latino Arts Festival. So I think it's just, the timing is just wonderful. And like you mentioned, it was at the Sundance Film Festival this year. It did receive the festival's U.S. Documentary Section Awards. So that was really great.
Yeah. Boy, if I could just stay up that late.
I mean, if you're able to, please come through.
Katie, you say that the screenings on Thursday nights are remaining free even at the UOP?
Yes, yep. So thanks to tonight, Summit County Behavioral Health is underwriting the films this evening, making them totally free, and they're also providing free meals to families. That's part of their initiative to bring families together over dinner and kind of share that common experience that really helps with kids, you know, to kind of stay out of trouble and just stay connected to their family. So that's really fun. And then next week with Latino Arts Fest, both La Bamba and the Rita Moreno film will be free and open to the public, but we do have to have everyone register, you know, for contact tracing, of course, but also so we make sure we don't exceed capacity. So if you go to parkcityfilm.org, you can click on the web pages and then register for the films. We'll have wait lists for all the films in case we exceed capacity. But, you know, tickets are selling well, and we're excited to be able to offer these great stories on the screen for free to our community again.
Okay. And right now you mentioned just only Spy Kids has got a waiting list.
Yep, Spy Kids has a wait list. There's always people that don't show up, so don't be deterred. If you want to come up, show up about 15 minutes before showtime. And there's always people that don't show up, and I'm sure we'll be able to get you in, capture the flag. There's still tickets available. And then next week for La Bamba and Rita Moreno, we do expect that those films will sell out. So if you think you want to come, you know, definitely put your hat in the ring, get your name on the list, because we want to make sure we get everyone in there and get to see these fantastic stories and celebration of Latinx culture on the big screen. And, you know, as a community, it's really fun to be part of Latino Arts Fest, and it's important to our community to come together in this way.
Yeah. In terms of precautions that you're taking, are there still COVID precautions in place?
Yes, absolutely. So just as we did last year, we are spacing the cars. So you get a spot for your car to sit in, of course, and then the spot immediately to your left is yours to sit in if you'd like to sit outside. We are requiring that people wear masks anytime they're outside their vehicle or if they want to visit concessions or restrooms. So we are still taking some precautions up there at the UOP, and just, you know, people have been very compliant, and it's been, you know, a great way to bring people together. And we want to make sure that, you know, as the chamber has marketed it, you know, to stay safe, to stay open.
Yeah. So will that mask wearing end, do you think, this summer?
It's something that we're evaluating. We'll keep those protocols in place through the end of this month. We'll be back in July, actually, again, with the Sundance Institute. We're going to be the host for their For the Local series in mid-July, and we'll have some other film selections as well. So it's an ongoing conversation. You know, the events community certainly has been hit pretty hard, and we're just starting to come back out of that. So we want to make sure that we are cautiously optimistic as we open up and invite people back into our spaces. So it's an ongoing conversation, but for now, those are our requirements. requirements, and you know, as that changes, we'll certainly let the community know. But you know, we appreciate people's compliance and understanding as we kind of move forward and again, stay safe to stay open.
Yeah, and Mateo, I don't know if you can speak to the rest of Sundance's summer schedule.
I mean, I'm happy to. So like Katie was saying, in July, you know, we're really excited to work with them to bring a couple of films that were part of the 2021 Sundance Film Festival, one of which is Flea, another one is Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Will Not Be Televised, and as well as Coda. So we have a wonderful spectrum of films that are going to be featuring that centers queer and trans experiences, Black archival history, and then, of course, children who grew up with deaf adults. So I think it's just a wonderful slate that we have this summer. And so just stay tuned. Just check out sundance.org for more information. We're going to be rolling out more registrations for all of those events.
All right. And that's typical locations have been like at City Park, Red Butte Garden. We're moving those to the UOP this year, or?
Yeah, I mean, we've been experimenting, right? So this year, for at least within Park City, we're trying to keep things outdoors. Like Katie mentioned, you know, even our events department was really impacted by this. And so we definitely want to keep people safe while still encouraging folks to come get together and watch some films with us, right? So definitely UOPs are leaning. And we do have a couple of screenings coming up in Salt Lake City. And we're also experimenting with how we share films with folks. And, you know, one of them is actually with the Latino Arts Festival, where we're actually showcasing a series of shorts of Latinx stories inside the Christian Center during the Latino Arts Festival. So it's somewhat of like an exhibition style, while allowing people to just pause and watch a film for a couple of minutes and then continue on their way. We're definitely trying to engage different ways of experiencing filmmaking this year.
Okay. And then Katie, no films inside the Santee until next fall?
We'll be partnering with Ballet Next in mid-July or towards the end of July for one film screening, and then we'll be back as actually part of the Park City Song Summit the weekend after Labor Day weekend for our kind of in-theater film screenings. But we do have a couple more films coming up. You know, this month we've got The Big Lebowski, so if you love The Dude and want to get your bathrobe on and get your White Russians mixed together, we've got that going on. And then we're bringing together a collection of short films from the Mountain Film Festival, which is a film festival that premieres at Telluride every Memorial Day weekend. And this is kind of their best of fest selection that celebrate activism and adventure and community. Just a great kind of reflection of the spirit here in Park City. So we're, you know, and then we'll have Sundance in July, some films outside at UOP, at the Utah Olympic Park again. And then actually we'll be kind of doing dual screenings in September at Utah Olympic Park and in theater, because we want to bring in our annual crop of ski films, but all those distributors or filmmakers want those films to be outside. So yeah, so it'll be kind of an interesting mix as we go forward, but everything will be at parkcityfilm.org. As Mateo mentioned, ticketing for certainly for the current films is up right now, but for the For the Local series, we'll be releasing that in the next couple of weeks. So we expect those films to sell out because it's an amazing selection from the 2021 festival that people definitely will want to see on the big screen and come together. It's just, there's nothing like that experience. It's been amazing to just bring people together, and just that joy that it brings to our community has been amazing.
Okay, parkcityfilm.org for the Park City Film Films, and then sundance.org. Is that, Mateo?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Anything else either you wanted to mention?
Wanted to mention, sorry, go ahead, Mateo.
No, please do.
Just want to thank our partners, Dragonfly Media Technologies, and our sponsors, Made in Park City and Switchback Sports, Summit County Restaurant and Wrap Taxes, our host, the Utah Olympic Park, as well as our programming partners, Summit County Health and the Sundance Institute.
Okay, Mateo, Katie, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. Take care of yourself.
KPCW News Time now, 8:56. Well, throughout the state, municipalities are enacting water conservation efforts to mitigate the effects of drought. KPCW's Jessica Lowell explains what steps that Park City Municipal is taking.
Park City residents should be watering their lawns at most every other day. But water resource manager Jason Christensen says the city is hoping people water even less than that.
But this year we're asking people to do a little more in concert with the governor's request. The governor's requested that all communities try and reduce one irrigation cycle per week. So that's watering every third day.
The city is only allowing watering from 7 p.m. to 10 a.m.
it's common sense. We shouldn't be watering during the heat of the day, you know, especially with temperatures creeping up to the highs that we're expected to see this week.
Christensen says compliance hasn't been a major issue in the area, but the city is accepting calls and emails about any sprinkler snafus. Christensen says for the most part, guilty parties broke the rules by accident.
9.5 times out of 10, we reach out to those people and they're like, oh my gosh, I am so sorry, because they appreciate we're in a drought. They want to do the right thing.
He says generally residents just need to adjust their irrigation controllers. The city is working to conserve water because of the lighter than usual snowpack last winter. Christensen says even though it wasn't the worst snowpack in the past decade, the soils were already dry.
And when runoff happened, a lot of that runoff went into those soils rather than filling the local reservoirs. But the bigger concern for the city, the community, and I think the state is just what happens if this becomes the new norm, you know, if we see this next year and the year after.
He says Park City is fortunate because it has a resilient water system. The city made investments in the Creekside Water Treatment Plant, which was built in the last 5 years, and the Quinns Junction Plant is temporary pumping water as well.
We feel good about the investments that the community has made in our water supply and the conservation ethic that we see here in Park City. You know, since the year 2000, the average home in Park City uses 50% of the water that it did in the year 2000.
To find out how much water you're using, you can visit parkcity.waterinsight.gov, which will give a breakdown of where and when you are using water the most. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
And a hotel development project whose planners say is not your traditional hotel heads to the Heber City Council for review. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more on the proposal, which still has an issue to work out after being approved by the Heber City Planning and Zoning Commission.
Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson called a Monday night meeting. A proposed hotel called The View on Main could host new guests and residents on Heber Main Street. If the city council gives the green light, it would have a total of 116 rooms for a maximum of 232 occupants. One of the developers involved said only about half of those would be temporary guests, though. At a Heber City Planning and Zoning Committee last week, the hotel was also pitched as a potential timeshare and condo property. Heath Tronston is one of the developers working on the hotel. He says he would like the project to bring a new upscale restaurant to the area, too.
Heber is starving for another or several more good restaurants, and I assume it will do very well, and I assume that there will be quite a few employees.
The Planning and Zoning Committee liked most of the proposed ideas for amenities, which included a restaurant, bar, coffee shop, gym, and spa. But there is an obstacle for obtaining bar and liquor licenses there. The school district owns the road to the property, 785 South. City law says that makes the hotel's location too close to school property for alcohol to be served. Brian Balls of Summit Engineering said the best solution would be for the city to take over ownership of the road.
That could actually be an issue for us when it comes to obtaining a liquor license. And speaking with the school district, they have always wanted Heber City to be in ownership of that, which is our first, you know, goal as well, is making that actually a public right-of-way.
The other option would be to purchase the road privately. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. Stay tuned for headline news, followed by Cool Science Radio. It's 9 o'clock.